This is Jean Shinoda Bolen, Goddesses in Every Woman. This is September 1985, tape 2 of 4.
Not until I get Persephone back. So Iris goes back and tells Zeus that that's what the story is. And in turn, every major deity troops down from Olympus, down to Demeter's temple, to ask her, to bribe her, to tell her, to appeal to her, to please make things grow again, because if all the humans are wiped out, no deity will be worshipped by anybody. So everybody's quite concerned. And to all of them, she says, not until I get Persephone back. So finally Zeus gets the message that he cannot ignore Demeter's pain. And so he sends Hermes, the messenger god, down to the underworld, to Hades. And as Hermes goes into the underworld, it's described as a scene in which Persephone is sitting downcast on a couch next to Hades. Now, she didn't adjust to the idea of being an abducted happy bride, obviously. She, too, went into a depression underground. And a Persephone depression is very much unlike a Demeter depression. A Demeter depression is... It is very different in that there is so much energy and so much anger in it, and there's a presence, a powerful presence in the woman usually, and that this is a suffering, depressed, heavy depression that everybody knows about, either in its agitated form or in its apathetic form. But a Persephone depression is a fade into the woodwork kind of depression. It is a kind of skitsy depression, like Sylvia Plath describes her own depression in The Bell Jar, as one in which she recedes, and it was like she was under a bell jar and nothing outside of her had life anymore. It was like she couldn't connect with, she couldn't relate to. She was cut off from life in her depression. And I think about Laura in The Glass Menagerie as being a Persephone, sylph-like, young, unfocused sort of young woman who lives in her imaginary world of her glass objects. Now, a Persephone depression is like that. It's like somebody who wasn't very substantial in the first place becomes less substantial. She becomes like Ophelia. She fades. Anyway, here's Persephone in the underworld. And when Hermes comes down and makes it clear that he's come to fetch Persephone, Persephone jumps up and jumps up at the notion of returning back. And then an interesting thing happens. She had, after all, been resisting Hades all along. And Persephone women sometimes do that. They get married because they feel they ought to, and because the man who wants to marry them, him, her, has such a strong intensity compared to her that she goes along with it, but feels abducted and relates to her husband sort of as a Hades or a beast, and becomes rather depressed in the marriage. Well, anyway, here is Persephone in the underworld, looking depressed, jumping up with joy at the idea of being rescued and returning to Demeter. But she does this curious thing. Hades gives her some pomegranate seeds, and she swallows them. And then she gets on the chariot and goes back to Earth, upper Earth, with Hermes. And there's this beautiful scene of reunion in the myth in which Demeter has been sitting and sitting and sitting depressed in her temple, and the chariot draws up near to it, and out of the chariot runs Persephone towards her mother, who realizes it's finally Persephone coming back, and they embrace, and there's great joy. And then Persephone is asked by Demeter, but did you eat anything in the underworld? Because if she had eaten nothing, she would have been restored as if nothing had happened to Demeter, and she would have stayed forever in the upper world. But had she eaten anything in the underworld, it meant that she would have to spend part of her life there. And Persephone had eaten 3 or 4 pomegranate seeds, which meant that she would spend 3 or 4 months of the year with Hades in the underworld. And we got from the earlier part of the myth that she had willingly swallowed them. I mean, she could have spit them out after all. But what she said to her mother was a lie. She said, yes, I did, but he threatened me by force, and that's why I did it. So the mother, so happy at the reunion, can make adjustments to losing Persephone part of the time. And then probably of what is typical of Demeter, Having had Persephone restored to her, she didn't just go off with her daughter to Olympus. She stayed around on Earth a little bit longer. And what she did was she provided to the people of Greece the Eleusinian mysteries that were to sustain them spiritually for some 2,000 to 3,000 years. And in the Eleusinian mysteries, it said that whoever was initiated, and at some times it was all of the adults in the Greek peninsula, whoever was initiated lost the fear of death. There was something about Demeter's mysteries in the Eleusinian mysteries that also were sacred and never told. There was a secret involved in it. And people have wondered, what was the secret? How come, given that at its maximum, 30,000 people went through the Eleusinian mysteries in 1 year, how come nobody told, especially when some of the early church fathers were also initiates? Because it's like the religion prior to Christianity, the strongest transformational religion that promised something after death was a goddess mother-daughter religion. And it was replaced by a God the Father, God the Son religion for the next 2,000, 3,000 years, which we're in the midst of now. At any rate, people think that it wasn't because secrets were always kept that well that nobody told. It was probably that it was an inward experience, that one knew that there was something beyond death. One got in touch with an experience that changed the person. And whatever that experience was just that, an experience that cannot be put in words and told. And the secret was probably just that it was an inward experience that changed the initiate. And that was, again, another aspect of Demeter, because if you think about Demeter as being first the biological maternal instinct, and then the nurturing maternal instinct, the third part of Demeter is a spiritual nurturing. I mean, you think about what a good mother does. First, she gives what the child needs in terms of food. And then she gives the child guidance in terms of how to be in the world. And maybe the third gift of Demeter that she has for some women, and Mother Teresa, for example, has a maternal side and a Hestia side, she gives some spiritual meaning, so that the spiritual givingness is yet a third aspect of the Demeter archetype. And with the Demeter archetype, one realizes that there is also the potential for suffering, for loss, because if you require a relationship to give your life meaning, relationships end, suffering happens, and depression can be a very strong element in a Demeter woman. Another part of the Demeter woman's depression may be due to sort of being burnt out. Because she is by nature a nurturing person, she finds it difficult to not respond to people who say, I need your help, I need your time, I need you, I need you, I need you, I hurt, help me. And when you think about Demeter women that you know, or maybe you are one, if you're a therapist, you may be seeing the most difficult non-paying patients who call you too much. Or you may be the teacher who gets straddled with the extra difficult child because the guidance counselor says to you, you know, you can handle this kid better than anybody else. And you know it's true, and you say yes. So that for Demeter women, the problem is being caught in the middle between the archetype, which is be Lady Bountiful, give, be nurturing, and people who say, do this for me. So the major task of a Demeter woman, if she is not to be burnt out, is to not live as an archetype, that is, to unselectively give. A Demeter woman must learn how to be selective in what she gives to and who she gives to by learning how to say no, by choosing who she will give to and who she will not. And it's very difficult for her to do initially because the archetypal force in her is to say yes, to say yes to being a mother, yes to being a mother in terms of biology, you know, get accidentally pregnant and have the kid. Yes to being a mother in terms of relationships with other people. When they say, help mother me, she has an impulse to say yes. So that the Demeter, the woman in whom Demeter is strong, must learn how to choose, how to say no and not now. Otherwise, she will be exploited by the goddess within her and the people who are outside of her, and she will be one bedraggled, burnt-out person. And at that point, she is like an apathetic, often like an apathetic Demeter, who just does not have the energy to do one more nice thing for one more needy person. Now, I see a lot of nods and stuff, so there must be a lot of Demeter in this room. Then there is Persephone. I got a couple of glimpses of her. One is the aspect of Persephone playing in the fields. And one is the whole configuration of that as a mother's daughter. Persephone is a young woman who is unfocused and unsure of what. She doesn't have a sense that she wants to have a baby or she wants to have a career. She's somebody who's sort of waiting for life to happen to her. And it could be Hades, not Prince Charming. And that is the basis of the Cinderella complex, pop psychology's version of every woman fits one model. And there's a lot of truth in the Cinderella complex, but it doesn't apply to all women at all. But it certainly applies to any woman who has a strong component of Persephone in her. That if she waits for life to happen, she waits to be swept off her feet. She begins life often not having a definite focus, and if she has a strong mother who truly cares about her but doesn't understand how different her daughter is from herself, the mother might be always feeling that the daughter is timid, doesn't know her own mind, so mother knows best. And so pretty soon mother is selecting her clothes and mother is choosing her friends. And the Persephone woman does not rebel or doesn't really strongly object often because she's unclear as to what she really wants. And so why not go along with mother? And then sometimes a Persephone woman lives out the Hades-Persephone-Demeter triangle. I've heard this one often in my practice. It's as if she falls in love with a totally unsuitable young man that her mother views as a Hades. And she goes through a phase in which she's sort of a pawn between the man and the mother. And this may happen even if it's suitable husband material, because the Persephone woman does not assert herself. She tends to be caught between the husband and the mother in a kind of triangulated situation. And because she's never been very good at assertiveness, I mean, everybody who's a Persephone woman should take assertiveness training for because her tendency is to say, I would really like to do this, but I can't because my husband needs me to do X, Y, and Z. Or, we can't go on that vacation because my mother is sick and I couldn't leave her. And what she doesn't say right up front is, I want to be here and that's why I am here. Or I don't want to be there and that's why I'm saying no. Now, she is like Persephone who voluntarily swallowed the seas and then told her mother, yes, I did, but I only did it because he forced me to. And that is the young Persephone, Persephone the core, K-O-R-E, or Persephone the nameless maiden. She also, because of her formlessness and her lack of distinct characteristics, is often a recipient, especially if she is very feminine, very beautiful, of anima projections of the idealized woman on her. And she is a kind of a person who then sort of falls into the projection. It isn't that she sets out to pretend like she's like the projection. It's just that there's something about her that is unformed on one hand and very receptive, attuned on the other. Almost a psychic ability to be related to the image that's coming at her. And so she will live out what Jung calls the anima woman role. She will be like the anima of this other person. And she will often then go through stages of life that have to do with the significant other in her life. So when she has a series of men who have chosen her as anima, she will appear different with one. You will see her in one phase, and it seems like this is a guy that is involved with the theater, and she is someone who has become really caught up herself in the theater, and she's there, and she's fascinated with it. And then 2 years later, you run into her, and that relationship is over, and now she's with some jock. And she's now talking about, she's perfecting her tennis game or whatever she's doing, and she's totally involved in a very honest and naive way. It isn't like she set out to do that. It's just that the enthusiasm, coupled with the susceptibility of her psyche to conform to the projection, makes her live out a series of roles, and then she kind of remains in some significant way untouched by the experience. That The problem with Persephone and the problem it presents clinically is a woman from approaching 40 who has lived out Persephone and waited for life to happen and never made a commitment to a person. Might be someone who got married, but somehow she never really made the choice to be married. So she treated her marriage as if it were something that someone forced on her, that she never was totally in. She might even be a mother, but somehow she didn't get that mothering commitment in either. Or more likely in this day and age of birth control and serial relationships and the capacity for higher education, more likely today the Persephone woman is a woman who's been the eternal student, who has dabbled in this and dabbled in that and is always in the process of becoming, but somehow hasn't quite done it yet, which is fine when you are in your 20s, and it's even fine in your early 30s, but as it gets, well, maybe it's not so fine then, but as the 30s go on, what happens to the Persephone woman is she begins to get depressed because she realizes that time is running out, that the biological clock is clicking, or she realizes that she has friends who have lived out real life in terms of family, in terms of career. And in contrast, she has played at life. She may have even had a series of rather interesting jobs. But somehow she doesn't feel that she's ever really made a career choice, and she's not made a relationship choice. She is in this phase of puella eterna, or the eternal youth aspect, which is part of the Persephone archetype. And the reason we have so many Persephones now compared to before is that life used to happen to women more, and that you got married whether you wanted to or not at that particular time. And the chances are, unless you were an out-and-out Persephone, that perhaps Hera would get constellated, or perhaps Demeter would get constellated. At least you knew that you couldn't flit in and out of the marriage. And so something changed. Some grudging commitment was made. Something changed in you, and you went from Persephone into Hera or Demeter. But in this day and age, where you can mentally cross your fingers when you get married and think, maybe, maybe not, it's possible for a Persephone woman to remain untouched by experience. And Persephone women often, in this day and age, where one chooses to have a child or not, will choose not to. So the downside of Persephone is that at a certain phase in her life, there is a realization that her life has not been fulfilling. On the other hand, women, especially women who are Aphrodite, not Aphrodite, but Artemis, Athena women, maybe Aphrodite to a lesser extent, because, and maybe, I guess all of them, I guess every single other goddess, if it is the strong part of a woman's personality, could stand to have some of what is the very positive part of Persephone, which is her very receptivity. That she does not enter anything with a sense of, I know what it's all about, or I have a definite opinion of this, or I don't like it, or even that I love it. She enters in her receptive way. The negative side is she's wishy-washy. The other side is that she's receptive. But she enters a new situation with a receptivity to trying to empathize, trying to understand, trying to feel out what the experience really is like. And for Athena and Artemis women who tend to be so focused, to try that on, to get extraordinarily more yin, by consciously trying to be receptive, there's a possibility of them being affected by whatever it is that one has entered, and that will have the capacity to have an impact. So that's the positive side of the Persephone the Maiden. Now, Persephone the Maiden in her story, it was a story of being abducted and suffering and then changing. And that's what happens to a number of Persephone women who go through life and life does happen to them, and something evolves in that process. For Persephone, the goddess herself, she grew to becoming queen of the underworld, because in all of her other mythologies, whenever any of the heroes went down, when Ulysses went down to the underworld, for example, or when Psyche went down to the underworld, there was never a sign on the door that said, "Gone home to mother." Even though she was supposedly staying 9 months of the year with mother and 3 months under the ground, Persephone was in her own realm. She was guide to the underworld. Whatever mortal heroes or heroines came down to the underworld, it was Persephone that showed them around. And many women who have been abducted into the underworld have been not abducted into a relationship that was the underworld for them, although that is one of the models. The other is that she was abducted into the negative aspects of her own unconscious. She became depressed. Perhaps she became psychotic. And the first experience of that underworld of the unconscious was, I am abducted, this is negative, I am afraid, much as Persephone was sitting on that couch looking depressed when Hermes went down. But one, if you think for a moment about what the experience would be if you periodically went into the underworld, if every year you spent 3 months in it, pretty soon it wouldn't be so fearful because it would get to be terrain you kind of knew. And then pretty soon you'd start to notice what this world, what this realm was like. And I know a number of women who have gone through a series of depressions, which is very much like being abducted into the underworld, or may have been abducted into a psychosis, as Sylvia Plath was, in a depressive psychosis. And out of that, it's possible to become a guide to that realm, that pretty soon it becomes much more known. And I think of Hannah Green, the pen name for the woman who wrote I Never Promised You a Rose Garden, who was abducted into the underworld of psychosis. And her underworld was amazing. I mean, it had its own language. It was peopled by its own entities. And she lived there for a number of years before she evolved out of her psychosis. And when she evolved out of her psychosis, she could write about it and in so doing become a guide for others. And I think about women what is her name? Previn, Dori Previn, who have been hospitalized for mental illness and whose songs describe something of the experience. And I think about the therapists I know who in their late 20s or maybe early 20s went through a psychotic illness and then they went into therapy, and then from therapy they went into school and have emerged as very sensitive psychotherapists, often therapists who are especially good at helping other people who venture into that realm. So this is the evolved Persephone, the Persephone that is queen of the underworld. And there's also in Persephone, because of her receptivity, potential to transform into all kinds of other aspects. It's sort of like a way to begin from. Persephone is very closely related in her mythology to Aphrodite, for example. There's a story about of Aphrodite falling in love with Adonis and deciding to forsake keeping, putting Adonis in a trunk and shipping him off to Persephone, kind of as an underground locker or something. And Persephone opens the trunk and sees Adonis and falls in love herself, or loves him herself, and says to Aphrodite, I'm not going to give him back. And then there's the Psyche myth in which Psyche, the human heroine, takes a box from Aphrodite in the upper world to be filled by Persephone in the underworld, a box of beauty. So there's in the mythology a tie between Aphrodite and Persephone. And in fact, many Persephone women go from being young maidens out of touch with their sexuality into Aphrodite aspects of themselves. So that is one way. There's also the mediumistic element that is potentially that of Persephone. Given that Persephone is so receptive and that she sort of unconsciously conforms to the stronger personality, you take it one step further and she's mediumistic. She can be a guide to the underworld through being like a psychic. And that is one of the ways that some Persephones evolve. So this is Demeter and Persephone, two of the vulnerable goddesses. And clearly they were victimized, and Persephone was abducted and Demeter suffered. And yet they evolved through the suffering. And that is very true of the potential life stories of women who follow the Demeter-Persephone path in any of its myriad forms, is that the probability is that suffering happens somewhere along the way, but the potentiality of growing through that is inherent in that archetype. The third goddess in the Vulnerable Goddess series is Hera, the goddess of marriage, and she has in common with Demeter and Persephone that element of suffering, and that potential for change. Hera has been given bad press, almost as bad as Aphrodite. And I think in my own description of Hera, if I were to rewrite it, but I know I won't, I think I would have been kinder to Hera than I was in my chapter. Because there are more satisfactions to a Hera life than I put in that book. And I had, though it's very much spoken of, I mean, a Hera woman is a woman for whom having a mate is the major source of her meaning. Hera was goddess of marriage, and she was the wife of Zeus. And in her mythology, she is made out as the archetypal shrew. Homer especially gave her bad press, and there are all the incidents in which Zeus played around and Hera got upset and did dreadful things to people. You see, she always typically vented her hostility, which came from her pain, onto the other women or the children that resulted from those unions. And she never confronted Zeus. And this is typical of a Hera woman for whom that marriage and that man or that woman, because these archetypes are present in all women and operate the same regardless of sexual preference. So a Hera woman who is in a lesbian relationship will feel just like a Hera woman in a heterosexual relationship. She will value fidelity and monogamy. She will want it to be honored by her community. And she will rage in pain and be jealous if her partner shows an interest in anybody else. But everybody needs Hera in them if for them to be capable of making a committed relationship and staying with that relationship through the difficulties that allow change in the partners and allow growth in the relationship. Without Hera, you end the relationship when it gets tough. And I remember the Gestalt motto, it was even on a variation, was on a poster, but essentially it went something like this, that we'll groove together as long as it's nice, and when it gets difficult, we will go on and groove with somebody else. And if you do not have Hera in your psyche, that's probably what you will do. That when it gets difficult or painful or tacky or whatever or boring, you will move on because you do not have enough Hera in you to make a commitment that will endure. And that is the very positive side of Hera. What is lost, incidentally, mythologically about Hera is her relationship to the great goddess. Because Hera, like Demeter, like Aphrodite, is a powerful archetype and was a powerful goddess. And that Hera was the chief major goddess in the Greek pantheon as wife of Zeus. But, you know, what happened to the great goddesses is that when the Indo-Europeans with their warrior god, and the main one was Zeus, invaded Europe, they found a matriarchal religion people that were not warlike and who favored agriculture and had goddesses as their chief deity. And what happened with the invading Indo-Europeans on their horses is that they conquered these people easy. And they had great contempt for people who couldn't fight well, because that was not the value of the early of the great goddess religion people. And so they were conquered. And yet the people still had an allegiance to the great goddess. And what occurred mythologically was that the great goddess's attributes were co-opted by being married to a major god. And then he became the carrier of that value. So that in Hera's history, she represents the great goddess in her aspect as goddess of the sky. But in her Greek version of her, she lost this quality because Zeus was the sky god, the thunder god, and he had all the power of the sky. But in her earlier beginnings, Hera represented the great goddess in her sky aspect. But as an archetype, what she seems to carry mainly for most women is the goddess of marriage archetype, or goddess of the being a spouse. And if Hera is a strong part of a woman, then she will be fulfilled through that traditional role of wife. And this is not a good time to be Hera, It used to be just fine. I mean, in the 30s, for example, middle American families were very much nurturing of hera. Women may have been virginal until they slept with the man they were engaged with, too. They may have actually stayed virginal until they got married. And then they were faithful and stayed married for 20, 30, 40 years to the same man. He was somebody with a regular job who didn't do a lot of traveling, who, in effect, left for work every morning at the same time, came home every evening at the same time, and for recreation he went out with the boys, and for vacations and social events he was with her. And there wasn't an ounce hardly of worry about attractive women he was working with or periods of unaccountable time, so that many Hera women never discovered that they had the possibility of the vindictive, jealous side of Hera, because they weren't put through that kind of personal vulnerability. And the context in which they lived allowed them to be, first, as Hera was worshipped in her religion, she was worshipped three times in the year, first as Hera the maiden, and then in the middle of the year there was a ceremony of the sacred marriage in which she became Hera the fulfilled one, and Zeus was called a Zeus bringer to fulfillment. And there was a worshipful service in which the goddess was honored in that aspect. And then curiously enough, in the fall of the year, there was a religious ceremony that was for Hera the widow. Now, in fact, Hera never was widowed because Zeus never died. But there was an aspect of her referred to as the widow that had to do with her going into seclusion. And it had to do with her suffering. Because there is in her mythology the repeated pains inflicted on her by Zeus's infidelity. And at certain points in her mythology, it's like she couldn't stand it anymore, and she went to the ends of the earth into seclusion. And this was the aspect of Hera the widow. And then it was like she was in Hera the widow phase until spring, when a statue of Hera was immersed in water and she emerged again as Hera the maiden. So in her mythology, she is viewed in this negative way as the jealous, vindictive shrew, but in her worship she was greatly honored as Hera the goddess of marriage. She went through these three phases. And these three phases were the phases that were the major parts of a woman's life. And in our culture, too, for some women, this is true. And as a model, for example, a model in our culture, I use Nancy Reagan, because when she became First Lady, time and time again in her interviews, she kept saying that the most important role I have is the role of Ronnie's wife. And fortunately for her, though she is married to the equivalent of Zeus, and that he can, he can nuke everybody if he wanted to. He is apparently a very faithful, monogamous person, and not a JFK. So that she does not have to. She is a secure, fulfilled Nancy Reagan living out the Hera archetype. And one gets a glimpse of her jealous side on hearing that when the daughter of Jane Wyman, Ronald Reagan's first wife, married, that the senior Reagans did not go to the wedding, and the films that were brought to them to see of the wedding had all pictures of Jane Wyman clipped out. So one can surmise, probably, that there is a bit of jealous Hera running around somewhere in Nancy Reagan, which would conform to the archetype. A Hera woman must, more than any other woman, learn something about the character and capacity to love of her partner or her partner-to-be. Otherwise, that archetype will push her into early marriage, giving her the mistaken idea that this particular man will be bringer to fulfillment, and he turns out not to be at all. So she is susceptible to being bonded through her archetypal proclivity in a relationship that will cause her great pain, which was true of Hera. So she would do very well when she learns in high school about her jealousy when the boy she's going steady with shows an interest in somebody else. When she in high school first learns how jealous and painful it is, she would do well to be very, very certain of the kind of person she's going to make a commitment to, because once that bond is forged, it's forged. And one of the major pathologies that come into my office that have to do with Hera are women who cannot get rid of what is almost by now a delusion that they are the wife. Women who have, I mean, it is delusional when the woman has already been divorced and the man has remarried somebody else, and she keeps the name as Mrs. whatever it was, and she considers herself the wife, and her whole experience is still tied up in that. I mean, that gets very pathological, and that is one of the possibilities on the pathology side of this particular archetype. The other interesting thing about the negativity of this archetype is that rather than go into depression, which is the difficulty with Demeter and Persephone, that is not the initial thing that a Hera woman does. She gets active. She thinks about things that she could do. Sometimes they aren't not very nice things. But she actively vents her feelings rather than initially getting depressed about them. Also in her mythology, there shows some possibilities of evolving through the experience. I mean, one of the things is if she can get unbonded, should she mistakenly get involved with the wrong kind of person, built into the myth is a possibility of once more becoming Hera the Virgin emotionally, and then once more becoming Hera the Fulfilled One, possibly through another relationship. So this is the Hera experience, and given that this is just one aspect of a woman, even when it's powerful, but given that it is such a powerful archetype, this woman, who is more like Hera than any other archetype, would do very well to actively develop other goddesses. For example, if she should learn to meditate in order to invite out Hestia, who I'll be talking about later, she would find herself a sanctuary within that would help her when she is in the problem parts of Hera. Also, it would be helpful if she had developed the capacity to truly assess people and not just be taken in by the surface qualities. In her mythology, she was really tricked into the relationship with Zeus. She really didn't have much of a chance to find out what sort of a fellow he was. And had she would have known from the beginning something of the life that she was going to lead. Because Hera was the official consort of Zeus, but in the mythology of Zeus, she was the sixth goddess that he was involved with. So the past history was that he had an eye for women, and marriage was not going to change that. And a Hera woman really can stand, as with the Aphrodite woman, as with the Demeter woman, who gets repeatedly pregnant and then has some difficulties deciding, then ends up deciding maybe to have an abortion and then suffers through the subsequent depressions, to know patterns. And every woman who has any of these goddesses in them, which is everybody, does well to know the patterns, because it provides a way to then not get stuck in the story that is archetypal rather than personal. So when his wife Rhea, who was sort of a lesser version of Gaia in that she was an earth goddess, when his wife Rhea gave birth to children, he swallowed them. And first was born Hestia, and as soon as she was born, he swallowed her. Now, Cronus was so anxious at the possibility of having a son that would supplant him that he didn't even bother to see if the kid was a girl or a boy. And so he swallowed first Hestia, then Demeter, then Hera, and then he swallowed Hades, and then he swallowed Poseidon. And then finally, when Rhea was pregnant with the sixth child, having had every single other child swallowed by Cronus, Rhea planned a way that maybe he could spare this last child. So first of all, when it was time to deliver the child, she went off to another part of the country where she gave birth to a child and then hid him, and this was Zeus. And she wrapped a rock in swaddling clothes, and Cronus in his anxiety came along and in his anxiousness swallowed the story that this rock with swaddling clothes was the kid, and swallow the story in the rock, and allowed Zeus to be hidden from him. And Zeus, in fact, did grow up to overthrow Cronos and become, in turn, chief god. Anyway, Hera's beginning then was the beginning of these other, all of the five early siblings that were the first generation Olympians. That is, she was swallowed by the father as soon as she was born, and then liberated when Zeus tricked Cronos into regurgitating everybody. And it said that he regurgitated them in the order in which he swallowed them. So up came everybody in one stone. And apparently the stone was one of the one of the scenic tourist sites in early Greece, was to see the stone that had gotten upchucked. Anyway, Hera spent the first parts of her life then in the bowels of her father, and then she was literally a born-again goddess the second time, and she was foster-parented by two earth deities, two nature deities. And in that period of her life, it was quite idyllic. And Zeus, who was her brother, but, you know, the Olympians never bothered about things like bloodlines. Zeus, who was her brother, had conquered the Titans and then become chief god, and his roving eye had made him involved with five or six deities before Hera. But one day Zeus saw this young, beautiful goddess, Hera, and he fell in love with her and was determined to make her one of the ladies in his life. So what he did was he changed himself into a shivering little bird. And Hera came along and saw the shivering little bird and felt for it. So she picked it up and in order to warm it, put it between her breasts. And as soon as he got that close to her, he changed himself back into his masculine form and tried to have his way with her sexually. But possibly because Hera was equal in rank in terms of being a goddess, for whatever reason, she did what many Hera women do, which is to say, not until we get married. And so Hera and Zeus were officially married, and they had a honeymoon that was said to last 300 years and had been quite blissful, after which came the phase of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, practically, as the story then is full of the hostilities of Zeus and Hera. That tendency of Hera's to not know really anything about the man that she's marrying in terms of character, in terms of past performance and past patterns, the tendency to be attracted to a powerful patriarchal man who has a very undeveloped relationship side, are all susceptibilities of a Hera woman. And given that she has such difficulty unbonding once she bonds, a Hera woman would do very well to learn her pattern and to really know the person well before she just allows the archetype to do its thing. So this takes care of this expresses the three vulnerable goddesses and their capacities to make significant the traditional roles of women, whether it be that of the daughter who is receptive to what happens to her, whether it be that of the mother who can truly form an instinctual or a nurturing bond with others, or whether it be Hera who can make a commitment and endure, and through that endurance make for change. All of these are the gifts of these goddesses. And I also just wanted to emphasize that of these three, two of them, Demeter and Persephone, have a direct lineage with the great goddess that preceded them. And it is Demeter who represented the great goddess in her aspect of the great mother, and Hera, who represented the ruling in the heavens goddess, which she did side by side with Zeus. But she had, by the time of Zeus, lost her tie to where she had originated from, which was the great goddess as sky goddess. So these are the vulnerable goddesses. And again, you have heard their stories and you've heard something of their patterns and gotten a sense of whether you are like them or whether your mother or sisters or friends are like them. And now to end this segment of this workshop, Anthea is going to come in and share with you something of the symbol level and the meaning through symbol of the vulnerable goddesses.
Well, I have an interesting time thinking about mothers and wives and daughters, because I was married for 7 years, but I'm not now. And I don't have a daughter or a son, and I have a different way of relating to those symbols. But I'd like to tell you some things that I thought of while I was listening to Jean, and I think that they were quite moving to me. Starting with Aphrodite and giving your body as a woman to the things that you find sacred, and doing it without questioning that and just giving the whole fabric of your being, I felt that my path had been different as I went through Hera, Demeter, and Persephone, or rather Demeter, Persephone, and Hera. And I felt that what had happened to Aphrodite for me was that she had had her light extinguished a lot, her radiance, and that she had been made into just the field to plow and plant and then use and abuse, but that her light is in here, and that her light is in different ways. The first one is her flowers, which I see as what she does best. And in me, for me, my flowers are dreams, artworks, ritual, and all sorts of things that aren't very heady. And I see myself as having Persephone as my flowers, and of the light of the flowers and the perfume of the flowers not having been very much loved and cared for. And I see myself as having gone to other people as Demeter and being and taking them as my flowers and saying, you know, can I water you? Would you like to sit in the sun? Can I put you in a vase? You know, is this the right place for your seed? Can I lend you some of my earth so that you can grow yourself? And it's all sort of taken for granted. And then there's the fruitfulness, and when my child has grown, or my flowers, the things that I'm doing, they've become mature and they're ready to move on into something else, and that means I have to give them back into the womb space. And that's hard, and that's not something either that I find that has been given to me as a knowledge or a gift of Demeter, is my willingness to let my child go into the tomb, into death. And into the tomb of the male is something that for me was very important, because I feel like my Persephone, my flowers, have had to go through 5,000 years of patriarchal tomb womb. And I don't think she wanted to. I know she didn't, because she resisted it until I was 29, when I said, oh, I have to go to university. I can't have any more flowers if I don't go through that Hades, or that death, what to me was death. Because it's not easy for a narcissist to go through most PhD or MA or BA programs. BA is the worst. It gets better. So, and my flowers and my seeds are all, they're different. It's like yours don't look like mine or anybody else's. And so my Persephone, when I'm Demeter, is a special flower. A thousand-flowered Narcissus who looks like me. Narcissus is the one who looks like me, but doesn't look like anyone else, but does look like God. Me and God. And for me, the danger with my Persephone was that I would cling to her blooms until they went dry. And then they would just be dead flowers and not seeds. And for me, my Persephone is the one in me who's too vulnerable to go through the Hades tomb space. because she doesn't want to look too closely at her beautiful flowers in case they should just turn out not to be flowers or the radiance that are in them should die. And there's something very difficult for me about using my mind on dreams and symbols and things of beauty, relationships that I have with things that are beautiful, and then trying to sit down and write her pieces about it that doesn't kill her. And so I'm more likely to say, can I lend you my earth? Can I put you in the sun? Can I water you? And keep doing my Demeter to her. And just, she will then always only be a flower, which is beautiful, but it isn't going to change the world enough, because I feel as though we need Hades' mind for that. And when I was thinking about Hera, and I've never thought much about Hera, but Hera and Persephone to me are very closely related, as I felt about it as I was sitting there feeling, and because Hera's bird is the peacock. And Hera was, as Jean was saying, was the goddess of the sky. And she got married to a man who took her position as god of the sky. And so then she became his partner, but with no rights. And he really didn't do what a good, loving relationship should be about, and so she was hurt very badly, because he really was, I would think, for me anyway, the mind that understands the beautiful eye of my mind, that understands about my flowers as souls and relationships, and understands about the necessity of perfume when I'm talking of beauty, and understands about giving my body to make something which is in its own right already beautiful and like God. And somehow I feel, as I was listening to Jean, that Hera is the one in me who is the Sky Queen, who has a beautiful mind and has a profound and a committed relationship to her own mind or thought, sky thought. And it's about producing flowers and fruits and seeds, and she's also the one who will stick with it, but she's not being given her position back as queen of the sky. When she sees, she'll see with the cosmic eye. These are the eyes of the peacock, and the bird of the spirit, the most beautiful bird there is. And I really wanted to say to you, I really wanted to say that I love Hera today, and I've never loved her before, and I've never appreciated who she is. But if we took her back, and if we took Demeter's ability to let something go and be reborn, which is in the body. If it's Aphrodite and Demeter and Persephone, you go through it. I mean, you go through it. This, not just this. If we could have all of those and in each of our story, and some of us, like me, might have a very different Demeter, Persephone and Hera story, that if we dared to think beautifully and to die gracefully and be reborn, then we might have an understanding of how it is that things get created that would really make us co-creators.
Again, I would invite you all to feel inward. First, to have some sense of Demeter within yourself. To have a sense of Demeter's qualities, and Demeter's weaknesses, if that is important to you, and maybe to allow your psyche to come up with an image for you that relates to your feeling connected with Demeter. This is to add yet your own dimensionality to what I've said and what Anthea has said and shown you. It's to come up with something from your own psyche that represents Demeter. And now I'd like you to shift to that receptive young maiden part of yourselves, Persephone, and to try to feel out what your own Persephone is like. And again, it might be the qualities of Persephone that are the young maiden, or it may be the parts of Persephone that have gone through suffering. But whichever it is, be with, feel with the Persephone within yourself. And then make another shift. Into Hera as you know her. There are so many aspects of Hera. Which aspect of Hera does yours feel like? And then, if one comes, invite a image or a symbol or a thought of Hera to come so that you will have that as part of your own understanding of Hera.
The last set of goddesses are the virgin goddesses, Artemis, Athena, and Hestia. And these are goddesses that were called virgin goddesses by the Greeks themselves. The other categories were my inventions. But the virgin goddesses were the three goddesses of Olympus who were impervious to Aphrodite and Eros and who maintained their own intactness no matter what. So while other goddesses and gods would get torn away from their usual function because they fell in love or because something disastrous happened to them or because they got involved in a war or whatever other element affected them, the three virgin goddesses, Artemis, Athena, and Hestia, maintained their autonomy and intactness in their own mythologies and never were victimized and never were moved beyond themselves into another place. They didn't suffer, nor did they particularly change. So there are elements, pluses and minuses, about the virgin goddesses. But they represent in women that autonomous, independent, I'm doing this because it pleases me, parts of a woman, that are being, women who are in these archetypes are doing what they are doing because it matters to them. And they are not doing it to please somebody else. And they are not doing it because they are intimidated by somebody else. It represents that part of woman who may be, in fact, in a vulnerable situation and have difficulties in life, but the part of her that stays pristine, unaffected, private, autonomous, even in the midst of something going wrong in her life. This is the Artemis, Athena, Hestia, or virgin goddess quality. The way the Greeks talked about, used the word virgin, by the way, is not the same as the way we use the word virgin. Virgin to us usually means never having had any sexual relationships and therefore being virginal physically. The way the Greeks used the word virgin, it meant that the woman did not belong to a man, that she was unidentified, unpossessed by a man. And I think of the word virgin as it's used in virgin territory, virgin wilderness, that kind of use of the word virgin, which means really unworked upon and independent. The three virgin goddesses represent different sides of this autonomous part. And the first, they all have in their capacity to focus the ability to go for or go in. Go in towards something, go for something, strategize towards something that matters to them. And they tend to be able to stay focused without much difficulty from intrusions from the outside world. So that this capacity to stay focused, which is much more like a spotlight as a form of consciousness, and at its most precise is like a laser practically, is the quality of consciousness that comes naturally to many women for whom virgin goddess archetypes are innate. I think of my own daughter's virgin goddess capacity to focus that showed up very early when she was just a year and a half, the capacity to put one block on top of another because it pleased her, and to stay totally absorbed in that task is very much a virgin goddess focus. And it's she comes by it probably in some ways. I don't know how these are. I don't think virgin goddess elements or the goddesses are particularly inherited, although there may be there. Because I as I work with women and talk with women, I'm very aware that one of the ways to sort out yourself from your mothers and sisters has to do with appreciating just what innate differences occur as to why you and your mother never did quite get a sense of affinity around certain things. The way to understand it sometimes is to understand why the differences in the patterns. But anyway, my daughter Melody and I do share this one ability, which is to focus, so that when I was growing up, I would start to read something and people would joke because they would have to raise their voice to gain my attention. And that ability to just hone in on something, whether it be something close that I'm absorbed in or a goal that would take 4 years to, when I decided to be a doctor, I was in high school, so that to become a doctor actually took from the time I made the decision to the time I got my MD. It was an 8-year direct course. And to have that ability to aim for a target and go for it comes naturally if there's an Artemis focus. Artemis was goddess of the hunt and moon, and she was the archer with unerring aim. So that metaphorically, an Artemis woman can aim for a target and hit it. She is a goddess, however, that was not armored. She ran in the woods wearing a short hunting tunic. And one of the things that Artemis women do have difficulties with at times is though they appear to be often very assertive in the world, they're actually rather vulnerable in their defenses. And so many women's movement women have found that they go in with some objective in mind, with some real awareness that whatever their issue is right, and they go for it in a sense to try and get it across, and then they get very wounded at times when they run into judgment and negativity. I first started to differentiate something of the difference between Artemis and Athena when I was doing Psychiatrists for the Equal Rights Amendment within the American Psychiatric Association, and it was distressing to me until I thought about the archetypal differences between women. When there were a group of us, women psychiatrists, who were formed around women's issues and would clearly take an issue like the Equal Rights Amendment and the need for the American Psychiatric Association, whose clientele is 66.5%, roughly 66% women, that if you are trying to help women to evolve and grow in this culture, your profession should certainly support a amendment that would help make it possible to do. You know, my organization went through this lip service versus putting your body on the line element when they gave lip service to supporting the Equal Rights Amendment, but when it came to holding an annual meeting in an unratified state, they went right ahead and did it 3 times in 5 years. So that in affirming the or reflecting back on the APA, the necessity to look at this particular issue, what I found, which was at first distressing and then understandable, was why were there some of us who naturally bonded together to look out for women who were our patients and who could also see that there were many issues in women's psychology that were not being addressed and that sort of thing. And why was there always, when we started to raise issues like this, another group of women who ostensibly were just like us? I mean, we're all women psychiatrists. We've all achieved in the world. We all also often had the experience of being the only woman in this group and the only woman in that group. Why were these women getting up and saying, well, I'm a woman, but I'm against the ERA because? Well, if you're an Artemis woman, you start out with feeling rather than thinking as your major function, probably. And so the initial thing is to be in the I'm right, she's wrong element. But that's divisive, especially if you learn very well to respect that other woman who is different from yourself. And then when within the Union Institute the same issue came up, whether the Union Institute in San Francisco would support the Equal Rights Amendment or not, and I saw a woman that I had mentored, in fact, who was an analyst, speak from the position of being against the ERA, I was more hurt than angry, which would have been my usual reaction when I didn't know the woman. And then I thought about, since I knew her well, why I would be so strongly in my position and why she was in hers. And it became very clear to me, because I had an Artemis archetype as a major archetype in me, and she had Athena, the archetypal father's daughter, whose main affinity was with heroes, as her particular archetype. And given where your archetype, what your archetype is, at least around this issue, there's a tendency to what political stand you might take. And that made all the difference. I mean, then it's like there's a whole realization that if an Athena woman is going to change her position, then she has to know more about what the issue really is about and how, in a cognitive way, it's important. And so it shifted my own sense of why a archetype is important in human relationships with other women. I mean, when you get a sense of why you and your mother are different, it's a lot easier to forgive your mother, for example, if she has been a particular kind of goddess that wasn't exactly friendly and supportive to the kind of goddess you are. And at that point, in exploring the difference, there's an appreciation rather than a distancing. Well, anyway, to get back to Artemis, as goddess of the hunt and moon, had an early beginning that was noteworthy, and that she was the one of twins. She and her brother Apollo were the children of Leto, who was a goddess in the Titan group, and Zeus, who was her father. And when Leto was pregnant with Apollo and Artemis, she had grave difficulties because Hera knew about it. And Hera, in her typical fashion, was being her vindictive self. And so she let it be known that woe on any place that would harbor Leto and help her in her time of delivery. So Leto went from place to place and was told, you can't stay here. We cannot risk Hera's wrath. And so she went on and on seeking shelter. And finally, weary and tired and on the verge of delivering, she landed on a barren, abandoned, unpopulated island called Ortega, which at that point was called a floating island and later became known as Delos. But anyway, there on Ortega, she went into labor. And in order that a vow that Hera had made go not be denied, at the same time that Leto have that child, Hera had cursed Leto and vowed that she would not give birth to her children anywhere where the sun shone. And so Poseidon, or Neptune, the god of the sea, made an enormous wave go over the island, and underneath that wave, Artemis was born. And then, contrary to gynecology, which says that twins come out pretty easily because they're little, and once the first kid gets out, the second one is a real easy delivery, contrary to gynecology, in the Smithology side of it, Leto, following the delivery of Artemis, went into what was known as the most atrocious labor in Greek mythology, and that is for 9 days and nine nights he was in this terrible labor that was unremitting. And again, it had something to do with Hera tying up one of the goddesses that had to do with delivery. But who Leto had for help was her daughter Artemis, because goddesses are not like ordinary folk. As soon as they're born, they're able to do something or other. And so here was Artemis, from the moment of her birth, being midwife to her mother, and also witnessing as her first experience the worst labor in mythological history. So Artemis helped her mother. That was her first act. And Artemis is the only goddess who has in her mythology a repeated history of helping, coming to her mother's aid. So Artemis helped deliver her brother Apollo, and then the next time we hear about Artemis is 3 years later, when in the hymn to Callimachus there's a story, a beautiful story, of Artemis visiting Zeus and her royal relatives for the first time. And Callimachus, the poet, talks about Zeus bouncing Artemis on his knee, so to speak, and being just delighted with her, and saying, "When goddesses give me daughters like you, it is worth Hera's wrath." And then, being an indulgent daddy, he says to his daughter, "Artemis, what would you like? Anything you'd like for me, I'll give to you." And Artemis, having a mind of her own, which is very typical of Artemis women and Artemis young girls, it's very different from Persephone, who's waiting around wondering what she wants. Artemis can name it right off. And at three, she said, "Oh, I'm glad you ask. I would like," and proceeded to say, "I would like a bow and arrow. I would like hunting dogs. I would like nymphs to be my companions. I would like a tunic instead of one of these goddess outfits. And I would like eternal chastity." Given what her first life experience was, perhaps it's not surprising. And then, being Artemis, she preferred to go and choose her own gifts. So she went down underwater to get her silver bow and arrow from the Cyclops, and she went to her cousin Pan and chose the dogs that she wanted, and she went in forest, mountain, and stream and chose the nymphs for her companions. And then also typically Artemis, this had taken most of the day, so she had her bow and arrow and her friends and her dogs and everything, but now it was getting too dark to see by. And so she is seen in some of her statues with torches, because rather than wait until the next morning, Artemis went out with her new things that night by torchlight. It also reflects something of Artemis's comfort with the night, because she is, besides goddess of the hunt and moon, besides goddess of the hunt, she was goddess of the moon. And this quality in Artemis, the hunting bow and arrow side, represents that achievement-oriented element in the world. The goddess of the moon represents very much a orientation that is almost mystical about nature, because Artemis women tend very much to be comfortable in nature and often go into nature for their spiritual renewals. So here's Artemis at three with all her stuff. And then in her mythology, she came to her mother's rescue when a giant tried to rape her mother. And then there is the other side of Artemis. It's quick to act. It's without mercy. That is the Artemis element. And it probably is because she is so caught up in her own sort of capacity to be passionately cause-oriented about something or other and not take into account where other people are coming from, what their feelings are in the subject, or what have you. So one of the negative sides of Artemis is the effect she has on other people. In her judgments, in her quick to act-ness, she may cut off other people, she may, in effect, strike somebody down. And this is what she did in her mythology when, to her credit, she was coming to her mother's aid. Her mother, Leto, was insulted by a foolish human woman named Niobe, who said, "You know, Leto, you have a beautiful son and a beautiful daughter, but look at me. I have six beautiful sons, or six handsome sons and six beautiful daughters. And in her bragging, Leto appealed to Apollo and Artemis to avenge her, and Apollo came and killed all six of her sons, and Artemis came and with her bow and arrow killed all six of her daughters, and Niobe was turned into a weeping pillar of salt. That capacity to act quickly and without mercy is one of the shadow sides of the Artemis archetype. Another time, a dire fate afflicted a hunter named Actaeon. And Actaeon was hunting in the woods with his dogs when he came upon a secluded pool in the forest. And there in the pool was Artemis bathing with her nymphs. And he had the stupidity or the audacity to not realize that gawking at Artemis would be a capital offense, because he intruded on her space and he just stared at her. And at first the nymphs tried to shield Artemis, but Artemis is known as the tallest of the goddesses, and so they could not do that. And Actaeon continued with his intrusiveness and his assumption that he could do that, and Artemis picked up the water in the pool and threw it in his face and transformed him into a stag. And his own dogs, no longer recognizing Actaeon as their master, but seeing him as a stag, then started tearing after him, and a fearful Actaeon bounded away into the forest with his own dogs at his heels, and what happened is they got to him and tore him to pieces, and that was the end of Actaeon. Now, when the women's movement began and consciousness-raising groups occurred, many a human man felt that he had metaphorically experienced Actaeon's fate, because in the raising of consciousness, the awareness of the chauvinistic kinds of things that happen all the time, which are the equivalent of intrusions and devaluations and things like that, women who were used to just accepting that as part of the notion, the normal social things that happen, began to know something of what these patterns were all about and began to become very hostile when such things happened. So a blundering Actaeon equivalent often ran into a hostile Artemis at the beginnings of the women's movement. Again, there is this sort of merciless quality that is part of Artemis. In one of the myths about a human woman who was identified with Artemis, this was Atalanta, who was known as a second Artemis because she was such a good huntress, was seen in the world with a twin-like man named Meleager, and the two of them were noteworthy hunters in Caledon. And what happened with her that gives some idea of the potential for change in an Artemis woman is that she went on a hunt for the Caledon boar that had been tearing up the countryside and trampling things underfoot. And essentially, the raging boar is a symbol of the negative aspect of an Aphrodite archetype, that when an Artemis woman gets enraged and feels behind a major cause, she can't have that "I'll trample over you" sort of energy. In the early days of the women's movement, some of the difficulties arose when women trashed each other. And that trashing quality is very much the Caledon boar element in her psyche. Well, what Atalanta did was first, the Caledon boar was enormous. It was the size of a rhinoceros, and it was smart. So he boxed himself up in a canyon so that the hunters had to approach two by two or one by one, and he was sort of doing in group after group of hunters. When finally Atalanta and Meleager approached him, and there's this image of Atalanta holding her spear, knowing where the one vulnerable spot was in that boar, which was through the eye. The hide was impervious, was pretty impervious anyway to being entered with a spear. So she waited while this boar charged her, held her ground, and then threw the spear right in the eye, and it went into the eye of the boar, and it staggered, and it was falling and faltering, but it was not yet dead when Meleager took his sword and did the final act that killed the boar. And so the pair had killed the hunt, had made the killing, And as a result of that, Atalanta got as a trophy the skin of the Caledon boar, which was flexible and not like armor, but it would allow her the protection of the pelt. And that is one of the things that that Artemis women often need to learn, is something about standing up to their own negative judgments or their negative energy and being willing to kill it off and transform it into something else that is that takes into consideration compassion for people and understanding for people. And the pelt often becomes part of an Artemis woman when she learns more about what she has to look out for, when she doesn't walk into a situation totally naive about the fact that if she brings this subject up, she's going to get some possible negative flack. That has also the sense of the spirituality that comes from being close to nature. And there's some beautiful books, one by Lynn Thomas called Backpacking Woman and one by China Gallen called Women in the Wilderness, both of which describe that when you go out into the wilderness, which is, after all, Artemis's terrain, you also go inward into your own wilderness within. And the Artemis woman is by nature interested in exploration. She doesn't like civilization with its well-trod road. She tends to often prefer to go into new areas. So she is often a traveler or a person who has moved from one university to another, perhaps, or she's somebody who, when she runs out of something new, gets bored, and so she has to think of new terrain to go into. And I think from my own Artemis nature, it was to go into the collective unconscious, that the wilderness that remained for me of great interest was what was going on in the psyche. And that is, again, a place where an exploration attitude is helpful to have. So this is Artemis, with her strengths primarily being able to be focused on something. As I told you about her, you realize that she was the only goddess that helped her mother, that she had women companions as her nymph companions, that she also, in her mythology, looked after the young of all living things. And in effect, as her, she was prayed to by women in pain. She is very much the goddess that represents the archetype of the big sister, or the archetype of the women's movement. And the woman that I think most personifies this particular aspect of Artemis is Gloria Steinem, who always looked as if she stood a head taller than the other women in the women's movement, and whose values of looking after women and the young and coming to the rescue of the feminine and all that are very much that of Artemis. Now, Gloria Steinem talks about her own relationship world, and it's so different from, I was talking about Hera and Hera's need to be bonded and her need for a committed relationship. And Gloria, in contrast, tends to have relationships that are very important to her, and they last for a long time. They may last for 10 years, but then the man in her life turns into kind of a brother and stays good friends with her, but she may go on, as she has gone on, she goes on then to another relationship. And she has been quoted on TV because people are interested in, how come you've never married? And she's just a very beautiful woman, and she has been linked with some, she's been linked with men. So the question is, how come you've never married, Gloria? And she has said, because I don't mate very well in captivity. Now, that is such a contrast to Hera. I mean, it's clear that there isn't much Hera energy there. And then the goddess that is that I've already said something about, that is like Artemis in being in the world and having to do with achievement, and yet is so different in her value system and in her loyalties, is Athena. And Athena was a goddess of wisdom and handicrafts. And I think that she represents for women the possibility that one could be beautiful and brainy, can can have the mind of a general or a superb chess player and still be a very feminine aspect, still be expressing a very feminine aspect. And I think it's remarkable that of the Greek gods and goddesses, the deity that represented logical thinking was represented by a feminine goddess called Athena. Well, Athena's beginning was also dramatic, in that Athena emerged out of the head of Zeus into the company of the Olympians. And it said that Zeus had this terrible headache, which went on and on, which was equivalent to labor pains. And some versions say that he asked Hephaestus, the god of the forge, to help by hitting him in the head with an axe, which was a caesarean section of sorts. At any rate, out of Zeus's head came his daughter Athena, and Athena came out wearing full golden armor with a spear in one hand, and she landed solidly on the ground at Olympus and emitted a mighty war cry. And in that moment, the earth shook and the seas roared, and here was Athena in all her glory. And from the moment she was born, she was a full-grown woman who had her father's loyalty, and she was loyal to him, and she became immediately her father's right-hand woman. Zeus entrusted only Athena with his thunderbolts and his aegis, which was a symbol of his power, which she carried very well for him. Now, one of the interesting things about Athena is that she didn't know she had a mother, and she maintained that she only had one parent, Zeus. But in her own history, that is unacknowledged, is that Athena is really the daughter of Metis and Zeus. And Metis was the first consort of Zeus and was a earlier goddess of wisdom. And Zeus tricked her into becoming small, and he swallowed her when she was pregnant. And he did this because it had been predicted that Metis would give birth to two children, a daughter who would have the courage equivalent to any man, and a son whose heart would win over the gods and men and who would come to rule. So Zeus, realizing that Metis was pregnant, fearing that she was carrying a boy that would supplant him, tricked her, swallowed her, and took her into his body. I mean, this is certainly symbolic of the whole co-opt, how the feminine goddesses were co-opted by the male ones. At any rate, what happened inside of Zeus is that Metis gave birth, apparently, to Athena, and Athena grew inside of Zeus and emerged as a full-grown woman, but unaware of her relationship with her mother. And her mythology, with maybe one exception, is all full of her support for male heroes. And she was a wonderful goddess to have on your side if you were going into war. And she only backed winners. I mean, she made them winners, but she liked people like Wily Ulysses, who would do what worked. She liked people like Jason that wanted to go steal a golden fleece from somebody else. She liked Perseus, who went and cut off the head of the Medusa and with her aid. And so she is known as the patron goddess of most of the major heroes of Greek mythology. Well, Athena's only story involving a woman that was of much consequence was a time that a foolish young woman named Arachne challenged Athena to a weaving contest. You see, not only was Athena the goddess of wisdom in the sense of not wise old woman wisdom, but she was logical, pragmatic, strategy thinking. She had really the mind of a general or the mind of a Greek shipping magnate. I mean, she was she had that kind of wisdom. And she was also the goddess who was the goddess of handicrafts, where aesthetics and practicality came in. So she was, and foremost, she was the goddess of the weavers, and some people called her the first.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.